Help me welcome John Young.
Well, good morning. First off, there's all the seats you want up front here, so don't, there's plenty of seats. All right, so let's figure out, before we even get started, how smart everybody is in the room. How many people had Xavier in the Elite Eight? Not one person. Not one person in the whole room had, okay, well, we're just kind of seeing what we've got here as we start. All right, here's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about making the American economy great again. And I've got to get somewhere that I can actually speak or I'm going to sort of lose my thing. And what we're going to talk about, we'll talk a little bit about the policies and suggestions, but I want to talk a little bit about the process. Because whether you are pro-Trump administration or anti-Trump administration doesn't really make a lot of difference as we talk about the process. What has happened so far since President Trump got elected? It's about the same answer to how many people pick Xavier, right? Okay? He and his people are starting to figure out it's hard to govern. It's hard to get things done in Washington. President Obama said in his second term, when he did not have Congress in his favor, he said he was going to govern with a telephone and a pen, right? And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how he did things. But so far, you know, President Trump comes in and he says, I'm going to do. And, you know, the people who are on his side clap and the other people go, no. And then we go through time and it doesn't happen. D.C. is a very sticky place, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. The one thing that we do know that has happened since President Trump became president is the stock market has gone up a lot, okay? And the stock market has gone up in anticipation of all these things he's going to do. But one of the things, again, that you see in D.C. is it doesn't matter what the topic is, roughly half the people in D.C. think it's their job to stop it. So it doesn't matter how good the idea is, if you're on his side, Chuck Schumer is going to come up with some way and say, no, we're not going to do that. Again, it doesn't matter. It's hard to govern. It's easy to get up in a political campaign and say things, but then you get there and you've got to get things done. And he's even struggling to get things done within his own party, and everybody knows they're going to have the health care vote today. So we'll see a little bit about what's going on there. But let's start with where we are. Because one of the things that presidents say all the time, and again, I'm right in the middle of the room. I'm going to try to stay right in the middle of the room because some people lean left and some people lean right. But almost every president who comes in says, I inherited a mess. You know, the people buy it. It doesn't matter if which hat they wore. I inherited a mess. And this president said the same thing. President Obama said the same thing, on and on and on. We see that. Well, let's just see how big the mess is. And what we're going to talk about again today, we're going to talk about making the American economy great again. Okay, that's what we're talking about. So we're looking at this through an economic lens. I don't want to get trapped left or right on social issues. So let's just talk about the global economy. From 492 to 1492, global GDP doubled. I have absolutely no idea who or how they figured that out, but take that as a fact. Okay? That it took them 1,000 years for global GDP to double. From 1492 to 1812, global GDP doubled again. So it took 1,000 years the first time, did it the second time in less than 400 years. You're starting to see something happen here. It took 100 years for global GDP to double again. Now, when we talk about global GDP and we talk about economic activity, that's the measure that we're looking for. We want more economic activity is better than less when we're looking through an economic lens. Global GDP doubled in the last 15 years. So if we go back to President Clinton, remember when President Clinton, not Mrs. Clinton, President Clinton, when he ran, his campaign theme was what? It's the economy, stupid. Okay? That's what he said. Little sign on his bus. It's the economy, stupid. So what you're telling us, if this is what's driving my popularity out there, hey, things are getting better. There's more economic activity quicker today than at any time in history. Okay? So not really a bad time to come in and be the president. The question is why? Why has this happened? And I think there's three big reasons why it happened. Number one is the global economy and global trade. And we're going to talk a lot more about trade. And we're going to talk about how we got there. But just take it as a given for right now that the global economy and global trade is good for economic activity. Whether it's good for a specific worker in Indiana or Pennsylvania or somewhere else is a different question. But in general, it's good. Number two is technology. Technology. Technology is really interesting. Everybody sees it's the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. Can you remember when you didn't have an iPhone or whatever device you carry? And if I said to you, you got to put them on this chair right now, okay, and spend the rest of your day without your iPhone, most of you would panic, okay? Well, how do I know what the weather is? Look out the window. It is sunny, okay? It's not that hard. We've all become addicted to technology, but technology has made us more productive. It's made us more productive globally. And then the third thing is capital markets and the free flow of capital. And I always like to use the saying, if you lived in Pakistan 100 years ago and you had a great idea, you couldn't get the capital to fund it. But the truth is, if you lived in Oklahoma 100 years ago and you had a great idea, you couldn't get the capital to fund it. That's true. But today, you can get capital anywhere in the globe. You've got a good idea, capital will find you. And that is what has led to greater economic activity. Okay? There are other things, but those are the three drivers of what's really going on. So that's what's going on globally. Now, Warren Buffett said that the preachers of pessimism prattle endlessly about America's problems. I've never seen one who wishes to emigrate. And Warren Buffett has sort of risen. He is our guru of the American economy. And what he's telling us here, okay, if you're worried about America's problems, go anywhere else and live with theirs. It's a pretty good place to be. We have things we can do better, and we're going to talk about that. But this is really a pretty good place to be. So let's just talk about the American economy a little bit and how we got there. Now think about the tense for a minute. I stole from President Trump. I said, making the American economy great again. So the tense is going to match up. But I would argue that the American economy still is great. Again, things we can do better, but it's the largest, most prosperous economy in the history of the world. How did it get there? Number one is the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Really a big deal. And most of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. We've had no foreign invasion on our soil since the War of 1812. Nobody woke up today, nobody, and said, I wonder if North Carolina invaded. Okay? Didn't happen. Didn't happen. And, you know, we all kind of laugh about that, but think about the rest of the world. Think about if you live in Turkey. Think about if you live in South America. Think about if you live, pick your place. There's things going on. And we've been protected by these oceans for hundreds of years, which has allowed our economy to grow and prosper. Natural harbors and river transportation. Just don't question the details. When the pilgrims got here and the pilgrims sailed into Boston Harbor, they said, this is a great harbor. I know the pilgrims didn't sail into Boston Harbor, but that's not the point. Okay? They came to Charleston. They said, hey, there's a great harbor. They went to the West Coast. They said, look, San Francisco. There were natural harbors here where you could get ships in and you could move goods. Then Thomas Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, said to Lewis and Clark, walk across the country and tell me what I did. First thing they found, you live in Pittsburgh, was what? The Ohio River. They went, hey, we can float down the Ohio River. This is really cool. Floated down, they got the Mississippi, found the Missouri. There was transportation infrastructure already here. Didn't have to build it, didn't have to do anything. 60% of all the commercially navigable rivers in the world are in the lower 48. A tremendous advantage as we got the U.S. economy started. Abundant farmland. Then they finally got off the boat and they started walking across Illinois and they looked around and they said, you can grow corn here, okay? They didn't, but you know what I'm saying. You've seen that big sign in the Chicago airport that says, Illinois farmers feed the world? Illinois farmers do feed the world. And when they raise all this corn, what do? They put it on barges and ship it down the Mississippi to New Orleans and send it where it needs to be. Okay? So we have great transportation. We can feed ourselves. We have harbors in the ocean. Things are looking good. And then we had raw materials. This may disappoint some of you, but the center of the steel industry was not Pittsburgh because they have a football team called the Steelers. Okay? It was the other way. They had the natural resources. They had what it took to make steel. Okay? In that area. We had it. The natural resources were here. Tremendous advantage for the United States economy. So all those things above there, they were here. Our ancestors, whether your ancestors came over hundreds of years ago or got here 20 minutes ago, when they got here, all this was here. All this was already here. Now, the next thing that really happened in this country is Madison and Monroe came up with something called the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And in 1789, we made Washington the president. And since that, for the most part, we've done things the same way. We've done things the same way. We've got checks and balances in our system of government. In the second term, okay, when President Obama came back and he did not have a Democratic Congress, he said, well, I'll just govern with a phone and a pen. His words. He said that. And if you leaned right, okay, those people lost their minds. He can't do that. There are checks and balances. And so he issued a bunch of edicts and executive orders. And what has happened over time is the courts have said no. And all those people leaned right said, this is really good. Leaned left, excuse me. So then we got President Trump. What is the very first thing that he did? He governed with a pen, signed an executive order. What did the courts do? They said, no, you can't do it. We have checks and balances in this country. And sometimes we get frustrated at the lack of progress we make. But that is how we've gotten here since 1789, the same way. Think about where else in the world that has happened. It's hard to come up with any place. It really is a strength to the U.S. economy. Then the one that most people don't get. When we think about the modern economy, the two great driving forces of the modern economy, what we have today, are World War II and the United States Navy. Now, going into World War, especially the largest war in the history of the world, is not great economic policy. But when we came out of World War II, who was the only nation left standing? The U.S. of A. Who was the only nation with a navy? The U.S. of A. And something happened at the Bretton Woods Conference. At the Bretton Woods Conference, for the first time in history, the U.S. went to the rest of the world, and the Bretton Woods Conference was the Allies coming together and saying, what is the world going to look like post-World War II? And the U.S. said to those people, we are going to have freedom of the seas. And the French and the British and everybody else who were allies looked at us and said, what? So we're going to have freedom of the seas. The United States Navy is going to guarantee freedom of the seas. Because to that point in history, we never really had freedom of the seas. How did the British Empire get to be the British Empire? They controlled the seas. How did the Spanish Empire get to be the Spanish Empire? How did the Dutch Empire, the Portuguese, on and on. And all of a sudden, you've got a nation that says, we're going to guarantee freedom of the seas. So we're going to guarantee goods, material, commodities can move. And that led to the economic revitalization post-World War II. A really big deal as we think about the modern economy. Second thing we did after World War II is we created transportation infrastructure. Most of us think about transportation infrastructure and we think about the Eisenhower Highway Bill, and it was a big deal. It was a big deal. But we also developed our railroads, our airports, we put money into ports, and we're going to talk more about infrastructure. But this led to the economic, okay, miracle that was the United States from World War II to today. And then we created educational opportunities. For the most part, and I don't know what exactly what it would be in this room, but if I ask how many people had post-secondary education, almost every hand would go up. Almost everybody went to college or learned a trade or did this or did this. If we were sitting here in 1938 and I asked that question, hands weren't going up. So all of a sudden, coming out of World War II, led by the GI Bill, we said we're going to develop the skills of our workforce. The skills of our workforce. So we separated ourselves from the rest of the world with educational opportunities. And then finally, okay, to get these things, and this is a hard thing for us to measure. We can measure it, but it's a hard thing to know why. The U.S. worker is the most productive worker in the world. Germany's number two. Nobody else is really in third place. That's a fact. Now, there's a lot of things that go into measuring productivity, but one of the things we know is people in the U.S. work hard, and they work a lot. You work more than your parents worked. And your parents worked more than your grandparents worked. And that doesn't mean that grandpa didn't work hard. That's just how we've gone, and we can measure that. A lot of other places in the world, especially in the G7, the amount of work that people do is going down. The French have this national obsession with working less, but then they can't figure out why they produce less. But that's not what this talk's about, so we won't go there. But so you can see this. So all this kind of sets up things pretty good in the old U.S. of A. And then on top of that, we discovered this thing called the shale play, which really, really, really is a long-term game changer. Okay? We could stand up here and I could argue that the United States of America is energy sufficient as long as you can see. And we could have a discussion about that. But there really is no discussion about whether North America is energy self-sufficient as long as you can see. We are. Whether or not we have to import a little bit from the Mexicans or the Canadians, we could talk about. But all of a sudden, this whole thing where people in other parts of the world can say, hey, I can control your energy supply, no, you can't. That doesn't mean that we won't bring in some high-test gasoline so y'all can run your Ferraris from the Middle East and all that sort of thing. But as far as basic energy goes, all of a sudden, we've got it. We've got it. So that's a picture sort of how we got there. George Washington said, "A people who are possessed of the spirit of commerce, who see and will pursue their advantages, may achieve almost anything." This is George, more than 200 years ago, who said, people who want to work hard, spirit of commerce, who see and will pursue their advantages, everything I just went over, may achieve almost anything. And he did not know that the U.S. was going to become the largest and greatest economy in the history of the world, but it did. It did. And those are a lot of the reasons why. So that gives us kind of a, I'm going to keep you on time, I promise. That gives us kind of a basis for where we are as we look at this, for where we are as President Trump comes in and takes the reins. Now, if we want to measure things that we're going to do to make the U.S. economy better right now, I've got one graph. It's the only graph. The interesting thing is, you know, usually you get up, somebody talks about the economy, they got numbers everywhere and graphs. Well, we don't know what's going to happen in this administration. That's what everybody wants to talk about. So this is much more qualitative than quantitative. But one of the things we do know, if we want the economy to continue to get better and continue to grow, consumers need to spend. Post-World War II, the U.S. economy is 70% consumer spending. So if I want things to get better, you better spend money. That's just the way it is. When do you spend money? There's really three things that drive people's spending habits. Number one is job growth. When President Obama left, we had 150 million jobs in this country. That's the most jobs in history. We could talk about the quality of those jobs and what people do. That's a whole different, but it's the most number. It's the most jobs in history. So a lot of people have a job. Last year, wages went up 3.9%. I work for a bank. I want to know who got the 3.9% raise. Okay, we didn't get them at the banks, but that's neither here nor there. Wages in this country went up 3.9%. Okay, and consumer confidence is the highest it's been since 2001. So all those are driving people to spend more. And we can see right here, okay, this is the spending curve, and it's going up. So that drives the economy. That's really the bulwark of what happens in the U.S. economy as we look forward. So with that as background, I want to talk a little bit about President Trump's growth agenda. And there are a lot of things on President Trump's growth agenda, okay? But we don't have time to talk all of them, so I got it down to six. Six things that I think we need to talk about as we talk about his and his administration's view of where we ought to go. Number one is global trade. Number two is tax policy. Three is infrastructure spending. Four is regulation. Five is government programs. And six is fiscal balance. Every one of those is really big. And I'm going to go over every one of them in about 2 minutes, because you got things to do and I got to get to the airport. So don't, if I skip your favorite topic, don't get mad at me. You can't cover the entire thing as we go through. But let's just talk about global trade, and let's try to talk factually about global trade. Under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Act, which President Trump told us he didn't like, candidate Clinton told us she didn't like. Neither one of them liked it. Okay, we don't like NAFTA. Very interesting, she didn't like it since her husband signed it into law, but that's neither here nor there, okay? But under NAFTA, North America accounts for 28% of global GDP with only 7% of the population. So on a per capita basis, North America is getting four times its fair share. You would think just as a basic look at, that's not working that bad. Now you can argue whether Mexico and Canada are getting a better deal than the U.S., and I understand that. But as we look at it, it's pretty good. Second fact is the United States has a large and growing trade surplus in agriculture and manufactured goods as well as services. Under NAFTA, when they say, hey, we're running a deficit under NAFTA, that's commodities and energy. But as far as whether we're sending people from Google to Canada to help them or Microsoft or whoever, yes. Yes, so things are going. We cannot look at NAFTA and say NAFTA's a disaster for North America, and we can't look at NAFTA and say it's a disaster for the U.S. as a whole. You can always go in and say for Fred or Frida it didn't work out. That is very possible. But just as we look at NAFTA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership needs to represent free and fair trade. Those are really easy words to write, really hard to make happen in real life. And access to the U.S. markets. Have you followed the Trans-Pacific Partnership very much? basically what it's about is these countries in Southeast Asia coming together to have a trade alliance. So it's Vietnam, it's Thailand, it's South Korea, on and on. And so all these, they're all getting together to have this trade alliance. And one of the things we hear, you know, is, well, if we don't step into this trade alliance, the Chinese will. What do they manufacture in Vietnam? Consumer goods, right? Who buys more consumer goods than the rest of the world put together? The U.S. of A. Why does Vietnam care about a trade agreement with China for consumer goods? They don't buy any. Okay? This whole agreement is about getting the United States tied up with them. They want access to our markets. It needs to be free and fair. Really does need to be free and fair. Who else needs access to our markets? How about the Chinese? Okay? How about the Chinese? This whole trade thing becomes very interesting because we don't want to make pens anymore. We've made that decision. Go out there and find a pen that was made in the United States of America at any price. You can't. We don't want to make socks. We do want to make 787s over here as you come into the Charleston airport, right? Okay? So you make these decisions. It's just a question of how many pairs of socks or how many pens it takes to buy a 787. That really is how it works. That's free and fair trade right there. Okay? And if you're the pen maker, you want to drive that number down as far as possible. And if you're the 787, the Dreamliner maker, you want to drive it up as high as possible. But there is a balance at where it makes sense. There's a balance at where it makes sense to have the person from Microsoft come and solve your software woes, your computer woes, versus sending avocados. It's all balanced in free and fair trade. But it doesn't mean that we don't want to participate. And one of the things that we've heard from the candidates, and especially President Trump, is a lot of these trade agreements were written to the detriment of the United States. They're written to the benefit of the other country. And for the most part, the answer is no kidding. Because a lot of those were written right post-World War II. We're trying to get the rest of the world, okay, up and running. Are we at a time where maybe we should balance them more, free and fair? Okay. But to abandon them makes virtually no sense. James Forrestal. James Forrestal served with FDR, and he became the secretary, first ever Secretary of Defense under President Truman. And they said to him, hey, the world is in disarray. Economies are devastated. What are we going to do to rebuild a peaceable world? And he said, for the only way in which a durable peace can be created is by worldwide restoration of economic activity and international trade. Think about this. If you manufacture John Deere tractors, everybody does, that's what we all do, and we sell them in France, and our number one thing we like to do is drink French wine, okay? And we've got this thing balanced. We get exactly the amount of French wine we want for that John Deere tractor. You think we're going to get in a fight with the French, okay? No. We want the wine. They want the tractors. On and on. That's what he's talking about. Global trade is good. Unfair or not free, bad. But global trade is very good as we think about it going forward. Tax policy. I got a typo up here, which I found the other day. It says the top one-tenth of individual taxpayers. It's supposed to say the top one-tenth of 1% of individual taxpayers. So if there's 1,000 people in this room, 1,000 people in this room, this gentleman pays 20% of the total taxes. Right there. This guy. Raise your hand. Come on. Everyone wants to know who the rich guy is. If there's 100 people in the room, he pays 44% of the taxes. There's the one percenters right there, okay? So one of the things we see, and there's a lot of proposals out there about what we're going to do about individual tax rates. And if you really read through those proposals, and there's about 7 different things that are in there under individual tax rates, almost every one of those in some form or fashion is going to help him, is going to help him. What do you think the chances are that Chuck Schumer is going to let that get off the floor of the Senate? Uh-huh. Really? And now President Trump didn't run on I'm going to help the one percenters. But when you get this, but he inherited this problem in that we have a tax system. If you were JFK and you were elected in 1960 and you said I'm going to do something about taxes, you didn't have this problem. They weren't tilted toward the one percenters. Tax base was much more uniform. So it's really hard to make a difference in what's going on individual taxes today without affecting the one percenters. And nobody really wants to do the one percenters because Rachel Maddow will have a heart attack if you suggest that or whatever. So, you see, you're with me. I know you are. Come on, stay with me now. So it's going to really be hard. It's going to really be hard. Plus tax policy right now, we're not the health care, but tax policy is what? It's caught up behind health care. Got to do something about health care before we can get to tax policy. President Trump has said, nope, we're going to vote on it today. Either passes or I'm moving on. This is really going to be an interesting circus as we see this whole thing play out here. All right, but what could we do? What could we possibly get agreement on? The U.S. has the highest marginal corporate tax rates, 39% versus a global average of 25%. We do. That's a fact. That's a fact. If we cut corporate tax rates, what happens? Corporations pay less taxes. Okay, that was sort of one of those easy things. But then what happens to the money? What do corporations do? Now they have more money. Dividend. They make a dividend. The money goes to people who own the company. People who own the company pay taxes on the dividend. Then what do they do with the rest of it? They run out and buy a new F-150, right? Things start to roll. Things start to roll. You start to see economic activity. But it's not like if you cut corporate taxes, the money just goes somewhere. We got to do something with it. So your company gets more money. You either build another plant next door, you dividend it out to your shareholders, you whatever. But the money starts working if we cut corporate taxes. And we can prove neither side doubts the fact that the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rates in the world. Neither side really debates the fact that if we cut corporate tax rates, it will bring jobs to America. It will. It will. But it'll take some time for that money to work through the system. We also have taxation on overseas profits. Really the only country left in the world that still does that, and that is a World War II hangover, which we could talk about for a long time, but we won't. Okay? But we tax overseas profits. And the numbers vary, but most experts think there's about $2.2 trillion, with a T, of cash trapped overseas. And that means that Apple has sold an iPhone in Japan. They've paid taxes in Japan on the profit that they made. But if they bring the cash back, they got to pay taxes again in the United States of America. So what are they doing? They're leaving that cash overseas. So there's a proposal to have a repatriation holiday. And it's not really a repatriation holiday if you read it. What they're going to do is they're going to tax everybody. Tax everybody one time. So they're going to go to the holders of the $2.2 trillion, and there's different rates, but just say it's 10%. They're going to run to those people, and they're going to say, you now owe us $220 billion worth of taxes. Do anything you want with the cash. Okay? It's now tax-free. Not, you've paid the taxes. It's behind you. So Apple all of a sudden has billions of dollars. Apple says, okay, we're going to bring it back to the U.S. Same story. What is Apple going to do with that cash? They're not going to put it in a savings account. Okay? They're either going to buy back their stock, which makes the stock go up, which creates economic activity, that'd be my last thing, pay dividends to their shareholders, or build a new iPhone plant in Charleston, South Carolina. They've got to do something with it. They're not going to sit on it. It's going to economic activity. Plus, the government's going to get $220 billion if it's 10%, right? What are we going to do with that 10%? Hold on. We'll get there in just a minute. But so you can see this is going to happen. Ideal tax system distorts economic decision-making as little as possible while still funding the government. One of the really interesting things that is out there in the proposals about individual tax rates is to do away with all deductions but two, the mortgage deduction and the charitable contribution deduction. Get rid of the rest of them. Get rid of the rest of them. There's a lot of other proposals in there, and we'll see what plays out. But everything else, okay, including those that's in the tax code, drives economic behavior. If you want to give money to Xavier because they got into the Elite Eight, okay, what does it matter if you really get a tax deduction? That only matters about the amount. I want to give them $100 if I get a 20% tax deduction, so give them $80. Why does it matter that you have this tax deduction? What is out there that drives, but it does drive behavior. We all do that. Well, I've got to make charitable contributions, drive my taxes down. Well, if you didn't have that, it would just adjust the amount. With interest rates on mortgages at 2.5% or 3%, what is a mortgage deduction really worth in today's world? Not much. Not much. It was worth a lot more when interest rates were 15% if you bought a house when President Carter was there. So we're moving this way, at least in the proposals. But this will be interesting. But if you think changing this healthcare thing is hard, and don't, again, I told you in the very beginning, I'm going to stand in the middle. I don't want to talk about healthcare from these stories that they have on the front page of the paper about Susie's going to lose it or Fred's going to lose it. But economically, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been a disaster. If you follow the numbers, I'm not arguing whether we want to have universal health care or not. It's completely different. But it's been a disaster, and somebody says, hey, let's change it, and the world goes crazy. Nobody's arguing it's not an economic disaster, but they're just saying, well, if we change it, even if it costs $1 million for Fred to have health care, we're going to change Fred's world. Well, no kidding. $1 million? You ought to have pretty good health care, and we'll talk about that. But change is really hard, and changing the tax code is going to be hard. All right, infrastructure spending, I talked about that a little bit. One of the things that made America great, President Trump got up and President Trump said, I want to spend $1 billion on infrastructure. When we get to fiscal balance here, you can see the $1 trillion. $1 trillion is hard. First of all, it's hard to spend $1 trillion, even in Washington. Really is. But so I just said, what if we spend 6% of the budget each year, which is $200 billion, and I'm going to fund the first year with the repatriation tax and the other. So we got that covered, okay, just the first year. We're going to spend $200 billion. That's still 6% of the budget. Hard to spend $200 billion. And we're not going to spend any this year because we don't have it figured out. I mean, it's going to be next year before we get anywhere on that. But we do have a lot of projects. Air infrastructure, highways and bridges, water and sewer, ports and rivers. The American Society of Civil Engineers, I think they're a pretty balanced group. They say we've got about $1.6 trillion in projects right now that we need to do. And we're not going to do any of them this year because we don't have our act together. So what's the number? What's that number going to be next year? I'm telling you, it's going to be closer to $1.8 trillion than $1.6 trillion. I don't know. I'm not a civil engineer. But it's going to go up, right? Because every year that things age, it goes up. So it goes up next year, and we spend $200 billion. Where are we? Same place we started. There's a lot of infrastructure out there that needs to get taken care of. But in the long run, absent this repatriation tax, we have to figure out a way to pay for it. We all have to figure out a way to pay for it. And I'm not going to get into this, but with energy again, very low. I don't know about where you live, but gasoline at my house broke $2 again. Matters of what your taxes are. But with gasoline at $2, is now the time to put a carbon tax on, okay? And use the carbon tax to pay for infrastructure. Because you just can't run out. It's great in a speech to say, I want to spend $1 trillion in infrastructure. Everybody cheers. Where are you going to get $1 trillion? Even in Washington, $1 trillion is real money. All right, regulation. Regulation's been a big one because regulation, if nothing else, this is what has driven the stock market higher. Because the people say we're going to have less regulation, which is positive for the U.S. economy. Less regulation leads to more economic growth. And that is even a little bit of a tricky thing to say because there are good regulations. I'm pretty much a free market person, even though I told you I was going to stay in the middle. I'm a free market type person. But the air and water in Charleston, South Carolina is cleaner today than it was in 1975. A lot cleaner today than it was in 1975. And all of us vote yes. I don't think there's one person who's going to vote no. And that came about because of the Clean Air and Water Acts, which cost money, okay? But we cleaned it up, and we continue to make things. There's work to do, but we continue. So there are good regulations. I don't want to act like there aren't good regulations. But the markets think that Mr. Trump is going to take the regulation pendulum back toward the middle, your left, my right, and bring it from the left back toward the middle. And that, if more than anything else, more probably even than the tax cuts or infrastructure, that is what has driven the markets higher. We're going to take the shackles off the U.S. economy and let things happen. That is a lot easier said than done. I was in Washington. I sit on the board of the, doesn't matter what I sit on the board of. I was at a board meeting in Washington. And we had a guy come in, and he was talking about how D.C. works. 2.2 million people, not counting defense, work for the federal government. 2.2 million people. Do you think they've seen administrations come and administrations go? Yes, they have. So they're going, hey, got a new guy over here. Hey, we're going to do some things the same way we've always done them. Okay? At the CFPB, and I don't have the CFPB up here, but the CFPB is one of these things that everybody's talking about because it came out of Dodd-Frank, and, you know, if you're on the right side, if we can just get rid of that, the world's going to be better, and if you're on the left side, it's the greatest thing that ever happened. 100% of the people who work at the CFPB are unionized civil servants. I got nothing against civil servants. I got nothing against unions. How anxious do you think they are to embrace change? Somewhere between zero and zero. Okay? Down there. They know, I got it. I don't need these new people coming in and telling me how to do my job. I know how to do my job. I know what's going on. And again, this is D.C. These people, and it's different, and we could all go up there and work if we wanted to. But again, told the story about the SEC. Almost everybody at the SEC, again, is unionized civil servants, and they have work rules at the SEC. And one of the work rules at the SEC is they work from 8 to 4:30. That's how they work at the SEC, 8 to 4:30. And if you happen to have to travel, because some people do, and your travel takes you beyond 4:30, you get comp time. We're in a small room. I started laughing. Guy looks at me and says, what's so funny? I said, my year would be over like July 15th. You know, I'm sitting in O'Hare at midnight every week trying to get home. But they get comp time. But that's the job they signed up for. So I come in. I say, you don't understand. I'm going to tell you how things really... and say, no, you don't understand. We work from 8 to 4:30, okay? Get this figured out. Change is hard. Change is hard on a regulatory front. Despite their best intentions, the folks in Washington get caught up in the mindset of we know what is best when history clearly tells us they do not. And I put that up there because I think it sets the tone. Sometimes they do. Some regulations have been good. There's really good stuff in Dodd-Frank. And I work for a bank. I'm not going to tell you that there's not. But there's stuff which has crippled lending in this country. So you got to take the good with the bad. This is what's going to take your breath away. 2016 federal regulatory cost estimate was $1.885 trillion, with a T, 11% of GDP. We spent 11% of GDP on regulation. Does regulation produce anything? Uh-uh. And that number shouldn't be zero, okay? But let's just say we could cut that number in half. What could we do? We could fund $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. This has gotten out of control. It really has. We just have to figure out a way to pare it back, okay, with all the stickiness that we have in Washington. Governmental programs. First one, you have to touch on health care, and I already went to the Affordable Care Act, and I already gave you my conclusion. Economically, it's out of control. When it passed, President Obama said to everybody, there are no new taxes in the Affordable Care Act. That's what we said, right? Remember? Many of you filed taxes in the last 4 years? Yeah, there are new taxes in the Affordable Care Act. How about that? Politician didn't tell us the truth, okay? Not the first one, not the last one. This didn't pick on Obama Day, okay? But it happened. And the numbers haven't worked at all. The cost of the policies, et cetera, et cetera. The U.S. pays $9,451 per capita for health care, number one in the world. Our longevity ranks, women is 25th, men is 27th. If you pay the most, you're supposed to get better results than that. Unanimously, okay, no matter which side of the aisle that you're on, people know this is because of government involvement. Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act are very, very, very inefficient programs. Money just disappears. Now, a lot of people argue we should still have them because they want to have universal health care, et cetera, we ought to have something. This is not to say that universal health care hasn't worked. This is to say that government involvement in the U.S. of A. hasn't worked. Fact. Got to think about these programs. Housing. Many of you are in the wood products business. Wood gets into houses. If you want to finance a house, what do you have to do? You got to get a mortgage, which is FHA, Fannie Mae, or Freddie Mac eligible, because in Dodd-Frank, they put capital rules on the bank that says you can't really make mortgages that don't go through these agencies. What do all those agencies have in common? Yeah, they all had to be bailed out by the U.S. government in the last 10 years, right? Because they lost their mission. Their mission, when we came back, goes back to one of the first things I said. Their mission was to get capital where we needed it. We needed to build houses in Oklahoma, and all the capital was in New York City. So we came up with these agencies, which guaranteed these mortgages, in a box that looked like this, and it worked. We got capital. We built houses. But over time, the politicians took that box, and what they do is started changing it. And, of course, the big change was President Clinton wanted to drive affordable housing. And the Clinton administration, they came up with sort of a theorem that everybody in America ought to live in a house. Well, we've pretty much proven that everybody in America shouldn't live in a house. It doesn't make them bad people. Some people should live in condos and apartments and that sort of thing. Okay? They're not there, but we changed the box, and we blew these up. You really think in 2017 we can't get mortgage capital where it needs to be without a governmental program? Of course we can't. The problem is these things are sticky. A lot of people work there. A lot of people get behind them. But we'll see if we can get rid of these governmental programs. The hot one right now is student lending. About a dozen years ago, the U.S. government took over student lending. Used to be they would guarantee student loans, but you had to go to a bank to get them. They forced the banks out, and they said, we're going to lend. We're going to be the student lending group. And when they did that, really the first decision they made was you could borrow 100 cents on the dollar to go to college. And if we had more time, I would tell you my story, walking uphill in the snow both ways, going to college and all that sort of thing. Couldn't borrow the money. But today you could. And so as soon as they said you can borrow 100 cents on the dollar, what did Duke do? They raised tuition. He said, well, if there's a third-party payer, we might as well raise tuition. Duke raised tuition. Princeton raised tuition. Wake Forest raised tuition. The University of South Carolina raised tuition. You get it. Right here's a fact. I went to UVA twice. I have a son who goes there now. UVA tuition and fees increased 115% in the last decade when inflation is up 19%. How can that be? How can that happen? And how can that happen everywhere? Third-party payers. So all of a sudden you hear these stories about these bright young kids who went to Princeton to study music. Princeton's a pretty good school. They borrowed $250,000. They got a music degree from Princeton. They got out. They said, oh, $250,000. He said, what can you do? They said, I can play the hell out of a harmonica. I'm really good at it. Okay? But I mean, you laugh about it, but it's a true story. And so now, we got 8.8% default rate. 5 million. Most of them are college graduates, are in default on their student loans. The worst thing, for those of you who are young in this room, when I got out of school, the worst thing you could tell your friends and mostly your girlfriend was, I've graduated from college and I'm living in my parents' basement. Okay, it was the worst. Guarantee your girlfriend wasn't going to be there tomorrow. Today, it's like a badge of honor. I'm living in my parents' basement. I'm paying off my student loan. Man, you got it figured out. Okay? And the student loans are so high. Why? Because UVA has raised prices 115% in the last decade instead of somewhere in line with inflation, 25%. And again, I put UVA up there because I went there twice, so I'm being fair, but every school in the world, it's happened. But it's happened because there's a third-party payer. And if you're 18 years old and you get into Princeton, you're not spending a lot of time thinking, what are my payments going to be when I get out, okay? You're going, I got into Princeton, okay? I'm pretty smart. And you move on, and it happens everywhere. I throw up public sector pensions here real quick, and they're interesting because public sector pensions are not, N-O-T, not guaranteed by the federal government, but everybody thinks they are. Federal government runs something called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp, and when they put this in place, they went to all the big pension companies in the country, which at the time were the railroads and coal and steel. And they said, here's what we're going to do. When you make your pension payment, you're going to make a payment to us, and we're going to guarantee those pension payments going forward. And U.S. Steel and Standard Oil and everybody else said, great, and they gave this money. And if things work out fine and your pensions are great, if it doesn't, the government picks it up and pays it. But at the time they did that, they went to the city of Chicago, and they said, hey, you can get on this too. And the city of Chicago said, don't worry about it. We got this. We're the city of Chicago. There's no mathematical way today that the city of Chicago can meet their pension obligations. None. Zero. Zero. Not going to happen. Only one state in the last decade, only one state in the union has lost jobs, Illinois. Only state that has lost jobs in the last 10 years. And it's because businesses are starting to figure out this public sector pension thing can't work out. So they're going to have to come to us and ask more money. So why do I want to be in Chicago? Do not be surprised when you see an announcement. I have no inside information on this. That Boeing is moving their corporate headquarters from Chicago, Illinois, to Charleston, South Carolina. Why would you stay there? Okay? We've seen this. New Jersey has similar problems, but New Jersey has New York right above it, so they've been able to mask them a little bit. But public sector pensions are a problem. The real thing in Puerto Rico, if you follow what happened in Puerto Rico, was not defaulting on the bonds. It was that they couldn't meet their pension obligations. It wasn't a great thing they defaulted on the bonds, but not near as big as this. But keep an eye on this because this is going to be the next big crisis. And the last thing we have under government programs is the Federal Reserve. When we all took money in banking, if you took money in banking, we all learned that the Federal Reserve was what? They were the lender of last resort. That's why the Federal Reserve was there. But then all of a sudden, in the last 75 years, all of a sudden they've become the arbiter of the economy. What should inflation be? What should jobs look like? What should? And all of a sudden they're micromanaging. And there's a whole school of thought now that says that the Federal Reserve would have just stayed out of the Great Depression. If they just stayed out of the Great Recession, actually we'd have recovered faster. But it'll be interesting to see, okay, as we do have more populism, how that plays out. All right, and the last thing I want to talk about before we get to the conclusion, because I'm staying on time, is fiscal balance. The number one benefit of historically low interest rates is the debt service and the national debt as a percentage of GDP is historically low. So we can all do the math in our head on a Friday morning early. Let's just say we owe $20 trillion and we pay 2% to carry it. $400 million, right? Got it. The number one detriment of historically low interest rates is the debt service on the national debt as a percentage of GDP is historically low. We can borrow a lot of money. Only costs us $400 billion to carry $20 trillion in debt. But interest rates are doing what? They're going up. What happens when it gets to 4%? Cost us $800 billion to carry that debt. It's out there. These numbers are real. They are real. Here's a graph real quick if you can see it. And I'm rounding, but when President Clinton left office, we owed $5 trillion as a company, as a country. When President Bush left, we owed 10, and when President Obama left, we owed 20. If Donald Trump is the president for 8 years, we can't owe 40. Numbers won't work, especially with interest rates going up. They won't. This is the one thing which is going to kind of come in, because it is great to get up there and say, I'm going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Walk out the door and everybody claps. This is going to shut it off. Because one day we're going to go to the markets for additional debt and the markets are going to say what? It doesn't cost this much, interest rates this much, this much, this much. And it'll choke that pipeline off. Okay? So this is real as we think about fiscal balance going forward. All right, I covered a whole lot. Let's just sort of come to a conclusion, and we'll let you get on the next thing. Yogi Berra said, I'm not going to buy my kids an encyclopedia, let them walk to school like I did. I throw this up here, first of all, because it's funny, and we're at the end of this. But one of the things that's interesting when you get up and you talk about the economy, and you talk about what's going on, is, you know, this is a big country. And a lot of people in this country, they get their information from... And it matters where you are on the spectrum. But they get their information from MSNBC or CNBC or Fox News. Okay? And we all like to think, especially if you're my generation, that when we were coming up, the Wall Street Journal and Walter Cronkite were telling us the truth. Okay? They were telling us the truth. But there's no doubt today, okay, that the news is biased. MSNBC isn't dumb. They got people watching MSNBC who lean to the left. Guess what? They lean to the left. We got people on Fox lean to the right. They lean to the right. Okay? And you can like it or not like it. It's not the point. But you hear these things. Then poor CNBC, they're running in place because their relevance just keeps going down because people get their news off their smartphone. So they're trying to figure out some way to be sensational. So it's hard to figure out when you see these things what's really true because people lean in. And the first thing, so I just came up with about five things, and we'll do this, and then we'll get out of here. If a $15 minimum wage is a good idea, a $30 minimum wage has to be a great idea. And we could spend hours talking about this. I'm not telling you that Ben Carson was going to be the next president of the United States, but when he was asked this question in the debate, he was not going to be the president of anything. Because he so desperately wanted to say, I support a $15 minimum wage, and he knew it was the wrong answer. How many of y'all have ordered fast food in San Francisco in the last 2-3 years? How do you order fast food in San Francisco? On a kiosk, on a computer, okay? San Francisco raised the minimum wage, that job went away. Now, hopefully, that person went back to school and then now work at Microsoft to make $150,000 a year. Hopefully, they drove their skills up to where they could make 15 or 30 or 60 or 90. But if we're going to pay somebody $15 to say, welcome to McDonald's, what would you like? Your fillet of fish costs $12.95. Most of you aren't interested in paying $12.95 for your fillet of fish, are you? That job goes away. There's nothing wrong with saying we're going to increase people's skill set so we can pay them $15 or $30. But just to say we're going to raise the minimum wage, We got two guys running for governor in Virginia. I'm from Virginia right now, and both of them have a platform that says we're going to raise minimum wage to $15. I promise you I'm going to give money to whoever runs against him. It's nuts. It's nuts. I started my first job ever, I cut grass. I cut grass, cut the neighbor's grass, cut my parents' grass. Got paid $2. I'm old, but I got paid $2 for cutting the grass. I could have walked in and said, you don't understand, I'm a $10 guy, okay? How many yards you think I'd have cut at $10? I'd go with zero, right? Zero. I wouldn't own that Roger Maris 1968 baseball card that I bought with that money. Anyways, that's a whole different story. All right, merging with a foreign-based partner, transferring headquarters location to due taxes is simply unpatriotic. President Clinton said, President Obama said that, okay? You can't move offshore to lower your tax rates. Where does it say that Procter & Gamble has to pay the highest marginal corporate tax rates in the world? They make 65% of their profit outside the borders of the United States. Why do they need to be headquartered in Cincinnati? There's a lot of good reasons for them to be headquartered in Cincinnati. But if the taxes get to a certain point, they can go to Zurich. They can go to Sao Paulo. They can go to Shannon Island. Okay? There is no reason. There's nothing unpatriotic about saying I'm trying to provide a better return for my shareholders. It's always a balance between what's good about being in the U.S. of A and what are the detriments about being somewhere else. Let's bring back the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and then free trade. That worked great the last time. Everybody knows the Smoot-Hawley tariffs? Great Depression and hit. Got to be early 1930s. Things weren't working out that well. Economy wasn't coming back like we hoped. Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to raise tariffs. Everything that comes to the United States, we're going to raise tariffs so that people have to buy American. Put in the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. 10 seconds after they did that, what did the rest of the world do? They put tariffs on U.S. goods. All of a sudden, that farmer in Illinois couldn't sell corn anywhere else because there was a tariff on it. We couldn't sell John Deere tractors, on and on. So not only did the United States economy continue to tank, we tanked the entire global economy. Protectionism is a bad plan. Free and fair trade is good. Got to look for free and fair trade. We need to lock down the borders and end immigration. That is what made the United States great. I do not want to get sidetracked on illegal immigration. But the labor force participation rate in this country is at a 35-year low. It's a lot because of the demographics. The baby boomers are what the baby boomers are. But we're producing jobs in this country, and we don't have people to take them. For hundreds and hundreds of years, we've solved that problem how? Immigration. Immigration. Now, I don't, you know, get sideways with who we ought to let in and who we not ought to let in, but we got to come up with a way to let people in, okay? Companies in Silicon Valley cannot survive unless they can hire immigrants. They got to hire them legally, but it's very important, and there's plenty of other things we could talk about. There are no problems associated with interest, keeping interest rates at zero for a long period of time. Free money has never led to a bubble. We've had 0% interest rates for 10 years. They're starting up now. They're starting up now. But in that 10-year time frame, we created bubbles. We know we created bubbles. I don't know where they are. They're in the stock market. They're in the price of lumber. They're in the price of gold. They're wherever they are. That's where they are. And bubbles do what? They burst. They burst, and they are. And when you went zero to solve another problem, you created problems down the road. But don't be shocked when all of a sudden there's too much of one thing or another. Teddy Roosevelt said, any moment of decision, the best thing you do is the right thing. The worst thing you can do is nothing. One of the things that you have to think about, and I have no inside track to the Trump White House, but they are really frustrated that they've got nothing done so far. You know, they got that thing in all the papers that say this is day 71 or whatever day it is. Okay? Well, what have we done in there? We've talked about a lot of things. We really haven't accomplished a lot. Now, one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to figure out how to govern, okay? And for the most part, being in Washington and government is trade-offs. They're going to have to give Chuck Schumer something. You can't go up there and act like you don't have to. They're going to have to. President Reagan figured that out. Or their presidency is going to become the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, who by all measures is a very good man, he got up there and said, no, we're going to do it my way. Well, 4 years later, they kicked his butt out and they put somebody else in his place, right? Washington is a big game, and you got to trade things. You get some things you want, but you typically don't do it by strong arm. But we got to know that they're going to try to do that. So keep your eye on what they're really pushing on. If after 3 weeks, you know, President Trump has said, hey, vote on health care, it passes today or not, we're moving on to the next thing, kind of tells you that he hadn't decided that's not the signature issue. Signature issue could be taxes. Signature issue could be infrastructure. Could be whatever. But you have to see. It could just be that he read his own book, The Art of the Deal, and decided, well, I worked hard enough on that. I'm going to go to the next thing. We never know. But keep an eye on this, and we'll see what goes on. I am 1 minute over my time. I want to thank everybody for having me today. I know that we've got some people from BB&T back here. They're over here. I saw the insurance group as we came in. We're really happy to be with your group today, and enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks so much.